You're listening to the Crowdfunding Nerds Podcast, a podcast that will help you succeed before, during, and after your crowdfunding event. And now, here is your host, Andrew Lowen.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another awesome episode of Crowdfunding Nerds. I am your host, Andrew Lowen, and I am joined, as always, by Rick and Sean, who is sexy and Irish and South African and so many other things.
Mess.
How come I'm not anything?
I don't know.
But you're a wizard.
Sometimes. But you are a wizard, yes. Woo. Yes, and on this episode, we are also joined by Chip Cole. He is the founder of Squatchy Games. He's a freelance artist and graphic designer who just ran a very successful Kickstarter called Cryptid Cafe. He also happens to be a client of ours. We were able to run the marketing for Cryptid Cafe, Facebook ads, and that kind of thing. And in addition to that, of course, I can't go without mentioning Deliverance. He's creating the rulebook for Deliverance. And so I have a lot of personal experience with Chip, and Chip has a lot of personal experience with us. How are you doing?
Yeah, doing great. Thanks for having me. This is awesome.
And so on this episode, what we're planning on talking about is work-life balance as it relates to Kickstarter, which is Chip would know a thing about because he has more kids than me. He has 9 children and a successful marriage, as far as I can tell. And
he seems pretty happy.
Yes. And he does a lot of stuff, man. This guy, you know, works. He does a lot. He balances freelance. And of course, he has to remember all of his children's names and everything like that. I have a lot of kids and I'm trying to be a business owner and a designer of games and that kind of thing. And Chip is just several steps ahead. So I can't wait to get his perspective on all things. I mean, you know, we always start up with this What's Up Nerds segment. I figure I better ask it again. What's up, nerds?
So we are in the process of creating a course for the Board Game Design Lab. We had our first sort of session today with a really cool guy called Chris Reese, and he's created a game called Damnation, this gothic horror game. And it's going pretty well. I know, Andrew, you probably could talk a little bit more about it. You were on it a little bit longer than I was, but it's an exciting project.
Yeah, you know, Gabe Barrett reached out and asked, you know, he said, hey, I have this website. It's called bgdlplus.com. That's Board Game Design Lab, just abbreviated, plus.com. And he wanted it to be a site for designers and industry professionals to get, you know, just a giant hub of information. And he asked us to create a course on marketing. He's like, what would you guys do for marketing? And so what we decided to do was, you know, there's a service that we provide, which is where, you know, we'll take a designer and then build their ad campaign right in front of them. It's often, most oftentimes, a designer that is maybe not able to afford a monthly management, or maybe somebody who knows enough or is willing to get their hands dirty, but just needs a little bit of a push in the right direction. What we do is we build audiences and ads and everything live right in front of them on a Zoom meeting. So what I thought would be a great idea would be to actually record a live case study of us doing this for one of our clients. And so that's what we did. So we're featuring this live case study as something that you'll be able to download, and I don't know for how much or whatever at this point, but we're going to fill it with some really great content as far as how to run a great ad campaign on a shoestring budget. And so that's what we recorded today. It was nice. Get some fun.
On a side note, one of the more interesting Kickstarter games out there, Star Citizen, apparently they raised another $50 million in the last 9 months. This is like the never ending raise money and never produce a complete product. Yeah. And there in fact, I heard rumors there's a class action lawsuit. I can't find it right now, so I don't know how truthful that is. But at the same time, they're still in, quote, development. How long can a company be in development before it's finally just like, sorry?
Yeah. So, you know, whenever a class action lawsuit comes out, I tend to take it with a grain of salt, because sometimes it's like, oh, do you have mesothelioma, or, you know, maybe you were exposed to asbestos as a child one time. And so let's sue for millions. What normally happens is the attorneys get all the money and you get your $12 check in the mail, you know, joining a class action lawsuit. Right. And so I tend not to be a real fan of that. The thing is, with this Star Citizen class action lawsuit, I kind of took the same view. But I guess what happens in Star Citizen, they sell ships for thousands of dollars. So after you have crowdfunded and, you know, you can at the moment walk around and explore and, you know, the game is playable, you can buy in-game items. And these ships, like large Epic ships are thousands of dollars, so, you know, $4,000 for a ship. And evidently what's been happening is people have been buying ships and they are not made. Like, they haven't even started to make the ship that they bought for thousands of dollars after having backed. And so that's where I think that the class action lawsuit, or if you, I don't even know if it's a class action, it might be just a simple, like, if you bought a $5,000 ship with Star Citizen and you're pissed that you don't have it after 4 years, then join this lawsuit.
They still don't even have an official release date. I think it's been like 8 years now since their initial Kickstarter. I don't know. I think they kickstarted in 2013. And I don't even know if that was the initial one, but that might have been a secondary one. So I think they did some fundraising before that. Like, I know, like, I think a reasonable, if you're doing a Kickstarter, I think a reasonable will be like 1 to 2 years, 2 years max. I think 8 years is a little extreme. Yeah, this game has so much potential, and it just seems like they keep, like you said, they keep dragging, and at the same time, they keep funding. So I'm assuming they've been using all their funds because they keep getting more and more. I mean, $350 million, I mean, that's a blockbuster movie.
All right, yeah, let's get into our subject at hand. Chip is here to really chat and kind of dive into work-life balance and what that looks like for him, and advice that he might have on that front. So just to kind of tee it up, what is work-life balance to you? What does that mean to you?
Oh, man. It's changed over the years. And I think I finally got to a spot where I'm happy about it. So I think everyone to be happy, I think, is what it boils down to, right? That they're happy with, you know, the amount of time they see me. You know, they're happy. The kids are happy. I'm happy with what I'm doing from a career standpoint. I think once you can get all that running and everyone's in a happy spot, then you found a really nice work-life balance. And then, you know, I think in previous years, it can get tricky where, okay, a job might be demanding of you too much. And so now you're not happy in that space, but you might be happy still at home and happy with the kids. So getting all those to align just right is tricky, but it's definitely rewarding when you do it.
That's awesome. And now, just so that everybody knows kind of what has recently transpired that has maybe thrown a monkey wrench into your work-life balance and given you new challenges that you didn't expect, would you kind of fill people in on what has been going on the last couple of months for you?
So I'm a graphic designer and illustrator by trade, and I was mostly working in marketing departments for other companies and wasn't happy because I was working on products I just didn't believe in, but did have a good balance with wife and kids. You know, come home at 5 o'clock, I shut off the work, and I was able to do all that stuff. And then after my third layoff, I finally said, okay, I'm done working for other people and we're going to work for ourselves. We're going to take our skills to the street and see what we can produce, and started getting into doing freelance and illustration for some of my former employers, but then transitioning into the board game space. And that then led into, wow, we could probably create our own game, which then started with Squatchy Games. Squatchy Games was actually born probably 2 years ago. I started creating these games and my son was watching and he was inspired by it, which makes me very happy because they're wanting to be a part of my day job, which is cool. Our initial game was supposed to be very different, but his game had more marketable potential. And so I kind of put mine on the burner and said, okay, we're going to produce yours more. We're going to start developing that more. And it was launched this is all very quick and we can kind of come back to it if we need to, but we launched a game called Harry's Place back in August of last year, which would be 2020, and failed miserably. Kind of went to all of our peers afterwards, you know, what happened, what did we do wrong kind of thing, and got advice. And some of it was very blunt. Some of it was very encouraging. Oh, you should have done this. The art was good, but no one really knows anything about it. And took all that feedback. And I think middle of September. So we let the campaign run its full 30 days and fail. We canceled it right before and got all the feedback. And so I think by the end of September, we started going back to the drawing board about what we were going to do. And from September to February, we redid all the artwork, renamed the whole thing, and actually started doing marketing at the beginning of December. And yeah, we knocked it out of the park. At the end of February, we raised almost $63,000. So much That's different awesome. Story yeah. from failing at $5,000.
Yeah, congratulations on that, by the way. And it just seems like so many wonderful things have come out of that. You've told me about licensing deals and you know, other things like that.
We had a company reach out. They're very interested in licensing the idea of Cryptid Cafe, the IP, along with the characters that we've created within it. At least my interpretation of those characters, because technically, you know, the Wendigo, Loch Ness, they're all out there. So we've just kind of given them a different storyline within our space. And so, yeah, we're definitely looking at that. which is, now I got to get lawyers because I don't know how to read legal copy, and now I'm getting CPAs, and I don't know what I'm doing at this point. It's all sheep by the hip.
So Chip, did your kids play test with you? Is that a big part of the development of it?
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. And what's nice is that because we had such a large family, right, 9 kids, I have a wide range of an audience. So like I've got my older ones, like 27, 24, 24. So I got the older kids who can look at it from a different perspective. And then I got my 10-year-old and my 12-year-old, and they can play the game, and I'm getting a different interpretation there. My wife, who doesn't like to play games too much, she's more like, she likes luck games. I'm gonna roll the dice and see what happens. I don't want to think about my strategy and whatever. So she's in that camp, and she actually likes Cryptid Cafe. Yeah.
So it sounds awesome, like the moral of this story is to have a lot of children, so that way you have free playtesters of a good age range, right?
That's actually where I was going too. It's like I think I'm making my own playtesters.
But another good point that I heard from Chip, and we've discussed this in previous episodes, is, it's okay to fail. It's a very good learning point. We've discussed this. There's so much you can learn from failing. And as you can see, Chip just went from failing to over $60,000 on his next try.
Failing was by far the best thing that could have ever happened to us.
Yeah.
Hands down. I would now regret having put the original game Harry's Place out. We have a much tighter game. The artwork is head and shoulders above where it was before. Yeah. And what's really cool, and this is probably that family life thing, is that my kids have seen it. My kids have seen us put a ton of effort into a previous version, completely fail, but then have seen the last 5 months of getting back up, redoing everything, putting all that work back into it, and then seeing that you can succeed the second time around. And, had we failed again, I would have kept at it. And I think that's an awesome lesson for them to actually have witnessed firsthand.
Yeah, I find it really interesting because there's always this, in a way, a contract that you with your spouse say, hey, I'm doing this thing and it's going to take X amount of time plus some unknown variable. And the spouse says, yes, I agree. Let's do this. I support you and that kind of thing. And as you develop the, you were telling me you went through this failure, a moment of failure, and it was quite inspirational using it as, in essence, a lesson for your children to develop as humans. I would imagine that became a memorable moment for your family. What do you have to, I guess, the concept of that social contract that you make with your spouse? Have you made some sort of arrangement where it's like, hey, we're going to try this, if it works or if it doesn't, or if we're going to take a certain amount of time away? Have you made boundaries that is like, obviously you can't just give every part of yourself to the game, otherwise it would just cause the rest of your life to shrivel up? Have you had that conversation with your wife at all? Or
I don't know if it was a conversation, an actual, hey, sit down, we're going to map this out, and these are the hours I'm going to work per day, so forth. It was more of, we have a lot of kids, we've worked for other companies, and it was, every check was penny to penny. Like, you were spending everything you earned without a lot of potential. Like, there wasn't a lot of, we're here, we're going to earn this every week, you're not going to see me for 40 hours a week, and this is what we're going to have, and that's it. And, there was this sense of false stability, and that's what happened with that third layoff. It was like, we're not as stable as we really think we are. We are at the whim of the company and its success and so forth. And so the conversation was more, why don't we take control of that? Why don't we get that stability and put it in our hands and be, let's steer that boat ourselves. It could be crazy. It could be risky. When we went down the board game path, I already had a lot of clients from freelance. So we were generating enough revenue to make it, right? But again, it wasn't in the space that I was totally happy with. So I wasn't having fun doing freelance. And so that was, you could feel that. But then once it became more about a topic that I liked, things just opened up a lot more. I think I was much more happier. And then that makes my interaction with the family happier. So we then had that conversation. Why don't we go for it all, right? I'm not quitting freelance. I'm not saying I'm not going to do any work for any clients. But let's put some extra effort into it and see if we can actually start our own company. And then come up with a business plan on like what the next 5 years for that company looks like, should we succeed. And the ceiling was far, far higher for us than it would be for working for someone for another 5 years. And so knowing that, she knew there was going to be a lot of hours. But the odd thing is that she sees me more because I'm doing all those hours here. I'm working at home. So she can just pop in at any time while I'm working, where you couldn't do that at an office. You couldn't, when I was working for someone else, it was like, oh, call only at lunch or call only if there's an emergency. That's really what it boiled down to.
Wow.
And so that left her having to manage the family, you know, Monday through Friday for 40 hours a week with very little support. Whereas now, even though my work day is longer, because I'll work very late at night sometimes, I can go downstairs and help out for an hour. You know, we can cover lunch together. We can work on this together. Someone's not able to do their homework. I can take a pause and I can go downstairs and help out the homework. Or actually, one of my kids actually works next to me when he's doing his homeschooling, when they have online learning, because sometimes they have to close the school down. Oh, someone tested positive. You're going to have to teach everyone at home this week. And he'll sit next to me and he'll do his schoolwork while I'm doing my work. And we're both listening to the same music. And that is something we wouldn't have had in an office space. So I definitely work more, but we definitely get more FaceTime out of it.
So there were two things that I heard. Number one is that you are a freelancer and you kind of have to balance that against the work that you do for yourself, which up until, you know, Cryptid Cafe was successful on Kickstarter and gave you a big check, it only cost, right? It cost your time, it cost resources, but it didn't necessarily make money until Cryptid Cafe funded on Kickstarter. Then you made a pretty penny. And of course, you're working for the potential there. So first question is, how do you balance freelancing for other clients? Like, let's say myself with the rule book that you've been working on. That's, you know, something like that with your own work.
I think leading up to the campaign, it's not too hard to balance it. Basically, I try and make client work the 9-to-5 work. And then I'll do my own personal project in the evenings, right? Again, which sounds like a lot of work. Only because you're having to deal with time zones and things like that. And the client has other deadlines that they're trying to meet. So doing that work during the day makes the most sense from a business standpoint. And then again, I'll just work on the Cryptid Cafe or whatever project it is we're working on it late at night. One thing I did learn is I will never probably ever do freelance during a campaign. So during Cryptid Cafe, I had 4 live projects going on still, in addition to running the campaign. And that was a major mistake. All my projects went long by weeks, and that's just a bad reflection on me. So that was one of those learning lessons that, you know, if we do another one later this year, I will definitely not have any work during that time. It's just one of the things you just don't know until you're put in that position. Because my first Kickstarter, it failed, and I'm like, oh, I got plenty of time. I'll just keep working while I watch this thing completely burn to death. But this time around, it was like, oh my gosh, I have to talk to people all day long, answer questions, help them out. They don't understand how to make a pledge, or they have questions about the meeples and are they going to have this? Are they going to have that? And what are stretch goals that you're going to do that you haven't revealed yet? Well, I'm like, I don't want to reveal them because I'm trying to create a sense of urgency here. So I'll let you know when they come out. And so it was way different this time around having to run the campaign. So again, going back to freelance, I think it's easy to manage it if I just separate it out. It's almost 2 shifts. There's like a day shift working for clients, and there's a night shift working for myself. And we'll keep that up until the day shift of my games actually outweighs the freelance, right? There might be a point where I start flipping it, where I have to do Squatchy Games 9-to-5 and a project or two at night. And then, you know, ideally, I guess at some point, it's Squatchy Games takes all my time. You know, if we're successful enough, right? I mean, that would be the goal.
You talked about how you schedule your work hours. Do you then also have very intentional and scheduled family time, maybe like on the weekend, say this time every week is family time, and this is where I invest into my wife and kids?
Oh yeah, for sure. You know, I try and be done by 5 every day. So it's still a 5 o'clock thing. I have late mornings. Like, I actually probably don't sit down to the computer till almost 9:30 because we're doing making breakfast for the kids, getting ready for school. And so I don't want to just check and see what they're wearing and then send them out the door. I want to make sure that I'm there in the morning with them. All the standard parenting stuff, brush your teeth, la, la, la. Just make sure they're prepared for the day so they have the best success possible. And then when they come home, I'll jump down and make sure they got their snacks with the wife. And then I'll finish up and usually off about 5:30. And then it's all about when we're going to make dinner together. We may have a movie night. You know, from 5 to about 10 is family time. And we'll do dinner. we'll watch a movie together. And then, you know, my wife and I will maybe watch a show or something like that. My office is currently set up in our bedroom, which is not ideal, but she's still like 10 feet away from me. She can be watching TV, reading a book, and she kind of has access to me because I'll jump back online about 10 o'clock and go from 10 to 3 on an average day.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Hey.
Now you did mention that if you did your next Kickstarter, you try not to do other projects during your Kickstarter. During your Cryptid Cafe Kickstarter, did you have any life balance issues, or is there anything you would recommend to listeners who may be in the same boat as you when they're running their Kickstarter?
It's funny because you read these. There's actually lots of articles. Hey, make sure you set aside time to run your Kickstarter. And I read them. I'm like, whatever. And I'm thinking these are weekend warriors. They have a normal job 9 to 5. So I can understand why they need to set time aside to run their Kickstarter. And set time aside to run your Kickstarter. Give everyone a heads notice that you're going to be on the computer 12 straight hours, 14, whatever, because you have so many things going wrong. You have so many people you have to talk to. And I had absolutely no idea, again, that it was going to be that much. And even after the first week, I'm like, it should slow down now. I think we're going to be okay. No, and we ran a 30-day campaign. So it was 30, 12 to 16-hour days straight. The family was very accommodating, and I don't think they didn't get very much notice. Like, they were kind of caught off guard that it was going to be that much time, because I was caught off guard at the same time. Knowing now, they're going to know. They're like, okay, we're getting ready to launch. Not going to see Dad. He's going to take a month off. So say hi, tell him whatever you need to tell him, kind of thing. But they were also excited, like, because they were following. Like, oh my gosh, Dad, you did this. You reached this level. You raised $15,000, which was kind of pretty close to our goal. So once we met our goal, they're all excited and they're sending me messages from downstairs. I'm like, you guys are downstairs, just come up and say hi. That kind of thing. And then he's like, oh, you got 1,000 backers. And they were, and I'd get, I'm like, you're in school right now. What are you texting me 1,000 backers for? You should be studying your math right now. Even though it took a lot of time, they were so psyched about the whole process. Right, they were into it. I mean, just absolutely into it. And they start. You know, my daughter's like, "You need a TikTok account. I'm creating a TikTok account for you." I'm like, "Whatever. You're gonna have to manage it because I have no idea how to run TikTok." She's like, "Okay, great, no problem." And so she's like, she started doing TikTok stuff. I have no idea what we post on TikTok as a company. I don't know what she's saying or anything, but it was interesting because everyone, once they started seeing the success of it, they want to be part of it. So my wife's like, I have to edit all of your emails. I have to edit all your updates. You are a terrible writer. You have no idea how to use a comma. And so I'd wake up at 10, I'd write the thing, and or not wake up at 10, but at 10 o'clock, I'd write my update for the day and I'd send it to her and wait like an hour for this. It looked like a piece of paper has just been slaughtered, right? Just red everywhere of what I've done wrong. And just, no. And we'd sit here for another half hour, rewrite my post, and eventually send it. And I will have made, like, before I sent it, I made one small change before, you know, without seeing her. She's like, are you kidding me? I read the thing and you went and changed this and it's wrong. You know, like, so there was actually a fear of doing updates for a while, not because I didn't want to tell the client, you know, the backers or anything. I just was afraid of her reading it. It felt terrible afterwards. I'm a terrible, terrible writer.
One of the things that I read frequently about kind of setting clear expectations is setting expectations for your backers as to when you're going to reply, when your hours, you know, I will comment or respond to comments between this time to that time, or, you know, comment to messages. If you had to do it over again, what would you do in that area?
While we didn't say this is our this is how we're going to communicate, we did develop an expectation to pattern. Our updates came out when we did our updates. They were probably every 3 days or so. So it wasn't an everyday thing, because I'm not a fan of campaigns that just hit me every single day with something just to say something. So we did them on average about every 3 days, and they came out almost always between 12 and 1. That allowed us to handle things that we needed to in the morning, then, you know, make sure all the ducks in a row, and then create the update versus let's create the update first thing in the day and then put out a fire afterwards. So I like the midday update. I would definitely do that again. I liked our spacing, because between the two update days, I can get a lot of the other work that need to be done on the campaign versus I need to write an update every single day, because they are time consuming. Things that I would probably try and create a template in the future, right? Kind of like an outline template. We're going to cover what's new or what we just achieved, what's coming up, and what you can do. That's kind of like, I think that's what we eventually boiled down to in our in our updates. We had like, hey, we unlocked this. We're going to announce this. And you can do this to help us out and get us further along. So it kind of became a three-part outline. That was helpful. I wish I had discovered that earlier on. But we'll definitely kind of follow that format moving forward.
Absolutely. Just took notes. What we achieved, what's new, and how you can help as a backer update. That's awesome. I also agree with the three-day update. I like that cadence because it's not too frequent. Like you said, you know, you're not feeling like you're spamming people. Also, I feel like if I had to write an update every day, that would be half my day just for writing the update, or a quarter of my day, right?
Yeah.
You know, maybe they can do that on campaigns where, you know, like a CMON campaign or a Mythic Games campaign that just they know are going to explode and reach a minimum of $1 million to $3 million, right? Maybe Awakened Realms.
They have a team at that point, right? I mean, I think once you get to a point where you could have a team and you have someone who's managing your social or managing your outreach kind of thing, then I could see you probably increasing that frequency. Again, with purpose, though. Like, I wouldn't want to just say, hey, we're all having lunch today. That's update number 7. We'll see you later. Right? That's just goofy. You want to be able to communicate with purpose and tell them, okay, this is what's happening. Right? Mm-hmm. This is what's going on. And you need time for things to actually develop. Right? You can't just be like, oh, one day passed and all of a sudden we've developed an entire new race for our game. Pretty surprising, right? So we've got a new update. And it's like, no, it was planned and you probably could have planned it for a better space or whatever. For those people who are doing it themselves, and that was basically me, because I am with the exception of my son helping design the original concept, the board game designer, I was the illustrator, I'm the graphic designer, the rulebook writer. And for the most part, with marketing assets, obviously with you guys helping with placement, audience building and stuff like that I did not understand. But email was on us. My daughter eventually took over the Instagram campaign, my oldest daughter, because she has to do it for her band. So I was like, perfect, you can do that. I don't know how to do an Instagram story, so thank you for your help. And I just kind of offloaded graphics as they came into her, and she took care of that and did a fantastic job with it. For the beginning, it was very solo, so I didn't want to try and put too much on my plate from an update standpoint, for sure.
That makes a lot of sense. And also, I think that that's a really important point as far as work-life balance is saying no to certain things. It doesn't necessarily always mean saying no to people, but it's limiting the amount of tasks that you take on at once. I mean, there's just not enough time in the day to update every social media platform that's out there and, you know, design an image, like a square image for Instagram and what used to be a rectangle for Facebook and other things like that to just be perfect. I think it's, you know, perfect is the enemy of good. I've said it before. I just feel like you control what you can and you pray for the rest. I mean, all of those things are so relevant to just, you know, keeping your sanity. You can't do all of it, but it's nice to have help. I find in my own pursuits that, we run a Facebook group, we have a Discord, and of course our email list. And I actually have fans of mine as admins on some of those things, like the Discord. Discord and Tabletop Simulator, both of those things, you know, there are people that do that for me.
Sure.
I'd like to be involved in Discord, but a big, huge fan that loves managing our Discord server asked if he could. And it's like, why, yes, I would love that. I think accepting help like that from excited fans is kind of an alternative if you don't have homegrown labor, right?
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. And I think we're in a bit of a different boat because we really didn't have that base yet. Right. We didn't have you are far, far away ahead of us than we were at this time. So a lot of it was on our shoulders. But I think moving forward, we will eventually start developing those champions. They are the ones that, you know, volunteer to work your booth. They're the one that helps, in exchange for a copy of the game or the flight there and so forth. I look forward to when we can offload some of that, not necessarily because I want it to be for free or anything like that, because I just want people to believe in it as much as we do. And that's what you're really looking for. Someone's like, yes, it's amazing. I'm so excited. Just helped. I'm here just because I'm so excited. I want to help them out, right? There's that level of enthusiasm that becomes infectious and it gets more people on board. And in your case, when you have a fan who's running your Discord channel, that says a lot about their belief in your product and what you're doing and what you're trying to create. And it'll be a lot easier for them to then express it to potential new people, right?
Yep.
It's so much easier to buy something off of someone who is just out of their mind excited about something, right?
Yeah, I 100% agree. And, you know, it's interesting because board games as just a general industry, they are a really fun thing to do in your spare time, a really fun thing to talk about. They're fun to play. They're fun to have involvement in. And when, you know, I always consider like when I develop a fan, it's not necessarily a fan of myself. It's a fan of the product. And it's almost like I am also a fan of my product, and we're kind of able to congregate around this common, you know, thing that we all love. So I think that it's, you know, if people volunteer, it's a real mistake to say, you know, no, it's okay. I don't need that help. But, you know, I've had graphic artists offer, oh, I would love to do all this for free. And while I don't want to take advantage of a graphic designer, if I really needed help in a pinch, I know that if they are so excited and wanted to do something for free for me, I will sometimes give them the opportunity.
So Chip, you mentioned that your workday ends at 3 o'clock and then it starts at 9:30. So you get about 5 hours sleep a night. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's about right.
Okay.
I've been doing that since college. So, I don't recommend it, but I have definitely trained my body for it. Because when I was in college, I already had 2 kids by the time I graduated. So I was doing parenting, full-time school, and working, you know, 30, 40 hours a week to pay for everything and then do your homework after work. And there were multiple times in college where it was 48 straight hours a week because you just had to get everything done and so forth. So my body is very used to waking up early, manage the kids, and going to bed very late. And I run very efficiently on 5 hours.
That's a big props to you, because I can barely manage myself in a day. So I have a quick question, and I think a lot of our listeners might be interested in this. So with your family involvement and all the other commitments you've had in your life, what was the time from start to funded for Cryptid Cafe?
Well, it's kind of tricky because we already had a Harry's Place built, right? And so we already had the game from a mechanic standpoint pretty much done. Right. And that's why we went to the Kickstarter, because we were ready to go. We ended up increasing some of the mechanics in the game. We actually added in some event cards that were not in there before. We changed up some of the math a little bit to make it a little bit more difficult. I think what the problem with Harry's Place is we came in and we were trying to make a game for everyone. And that is advice I would give to everyone, not to make a game for everyone. Make it for your market. Make it for that specific set of players or that specific set of fans. There are enough people who will back it to make it successful. There's an audience that's big enough to make it work. Unless it's some, I guess, super, 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 super obscure maybe, where, you know, it's a goat worshiper, cheese making, going down the mountain game. I don't know, maybe that's a small audience. But for the most part, you're going to find an audience that is in tune with what you're creating. And that'll be big enough to back it. Because I guess on average, you only need like 300 people really to back a game. And we've got millions of people in the US alone, right? That I can't imagine you can't find 299 other people like you to create that game. Going back to your question, it took about 6 months from when my son presented it to me, his version of it, which is very bare bones, to get it to where we were at Harry's Place. That included me drawing all the creatures. These were all made up creatures at the time, box art, testing it, and we created a couple of prototypes and sent them out, and they got lukewarm responses. So that was the first 6 months. Then it failed, and we were off for about a month, maybe almost 6 weeks, because of the whole, okay, we failed. What do we want to learn from that failure? And we started back up at the end of September. So from another 5 months, because we launched at the beginning of January, so four and a half months, we redid everything, right? Like I said before, so it was all new art. We had to retest everything because we added new elements that were not there before, and start the marketing and launch January 26th is when we launched, and we ended February 26th or 25th. That was an intense 4.5 months, because you had Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas, three major holidays in that same time, where I was putting in crazy hours to turn this thing around.
So question actually related to all of these children behind me, you know, sometimes when I finish my workday and I walk downstairs and it's family time and I'm supposed to be spending time with the family, focusing on the family, being present and that kind of thing. It's really hard to get my mind off of work, especially something that needs doing. Let's say our rule book that we've been working on lately. I have these examples that I have to get back to you. You handed me proofs and it's like, all right, now it's my responsibility to, you know, finish. Maybe we should keep that on the podcast. She's very opinionated. That's Elizabeth. She's one. So sometimes it's just hard to flip the switch from work to play, you know, or work to family and that kind of thing. Sometimes I end up talking to my wife about things that really are meant for the workday, like manufacturing things or, you know, whatever, design things. And so how do you flip that switch from work to play or family or not work?
Now, when you shut down for the day, are you planning to go back to work later on that night?
Usually I do not.
See, I already know that I'm going to be back on it 6 hours later, 5 hours later. So for me to shut off is easier because I know, you know, if I'm coming down at 5 o'clock, we're going to start dinner, I can put everything into it because 5 hours later at 10 o'clock, I'm going to be right back to it for a few more hours. So I have the benefit of knowing that I'll be able to answer those things or take care of those things that, you know, I walked away at 5 o'clock that were maybe left unfinished, and I can go back and take care of those a few hours later.
Your order of priorities, I guess, maybe strategies that help you keep those things in balance.
I think the big thing with the kids and with my wife is it's listening and really being a champion of what they're trying to achieve. I love seeing them learn. I love seeing them succeed. And that just completely drives me on my end. Like, I could go all day without talking to them at all about the game, about what I'm trying to create. I have no problem. They don't want any interest in what I'm trying to do. That's completely fine. But I'm all about wanting to know what they want to do, what they want to do. And you know, my son's like, hey, let's get the membership. I need to start working out because I'm going to go for football this year. And I'm like, sweet, excellent. I'm going to, I don't know how I'm going to do this, but supposedly I'm supposed to wake up at 6 and start working out with him. So that then reduces my sleep time to 3. So I might have to make an adjustment coming into the future. My oldest daughter, she is a rock and roll singer. She's got her band, Wilderness. They are amazing. You know, they've been on Carson Daly. They've been touring the country. I mean, it is so crazy watching that happen in front of your eyes. You're like, oh, that's my daughter on stage currently singing to 15,000 people, which is just nuts. It's mind-boggling, right? Or they're opening up for Blink 182. Wow, so cool. It's weird because I'll be driving down the highway and her song will come on the radio. And it's like, that's my daughter. That's not at all. And you're just like, that's amazing.
For pre-Kickstarter, obviously it's going to be really easy to just spin your wheels and try to share your stuff on Facebook groups and make not make great progress. But what were the things that actually made a difference for you pre-Kickstarter that you did? And what advice would you give so that others listening can, you know, focus on those mm-hmm. things and not focus on what, you know, just takes time but doesn't produce results?
It's almost like a broken wheel. And because you do hear a lot, it's like, you know, build an audience, you know, get involved with the community, and really make sure your product is ready to go at launch. And you do hear that in a lot of spaces. And a lot of people, I think they're the exception and they can ignore it. Like, oh, I launched with 100 people and I raised $1 million, right? And it's not. You're not the exception. And even if you were the exception, had you put more effort into it, you probably would have raised $10 million instead of $1 million. So I'm a perfect example of it, right? For Harry's Place, we had 100 people on the email list and probably 75 of them were my family, right? So we had just an abysmal email list. We had, I had not been sharing very much on Harry on the social channels or in the different groups. I didn't understand how to involve people in the game without sounding like advertising. It's like, oh, hey, Harry's Place coming out, la, la, la. Or what do you think of this creature that's going to be in Harry's Place, la, la, la. And so I didn't understand how to create that engagement, get people excited about it, get that feedback from people so that they'd want to know more. And then we had no advertising. Like, I was like, I'm going to spend $5 a day for 2 weeks and that should really bring in everything. And it didn't work, right? We didn't get past our friends and family circle. If you can't get past your friends and family, it is not going to succeed, period.
So you mentioned that you kind of failed to engage, create that engagement pre-Kickstarter with Harry's Place, mm-hmm. but that you found a ways to do it with Cryptid Cafe. It sounds like that. How do you do that without being spammy and salesy, you know?
Genuine. I think if you're just genuine, it comes across. So we had changed, so we'd failed, and I was very open, like, hey, we screwed this up. We didn't do this right. You know, I'm thinking of renaming the game. And I went into the design group at that point and say, this is what our game's about. I'm thinking about calling it a Harry's Place, a Cryptid Cafe. And someone's like, no, just call it Cryptid Cafe. That's your winner right there. And I was like, oh, and it kind of grew on me. And actually, I didn't even know it was going to be cryptids, because I know Sasquatch because I live in Colorado, and that's our big cryptid, right? That's our local cryptid. Go Sasquatch, right? And everyone, there's, you know, if you're in Maryland, it's like, or Virginia, it's go Flatwoods Monster. Yes, that's us. Blah, blah. And then you got, so everyone's got kind of their cryptid that they like. And this is a little bit of a tangent. I'll go back to where we were. I didn't understand cryptids when I first started this game. We reached out from another company, and they're like, hey, we create this box. It's like one of those mail order cryptid crate things. And we love the idea, and we want the game in our box if we can work out pricing. And it was that then told me I need to refocus the game. I'm onto something. I'm not there, but I'm definitely onto something, right? And there's an audience for this something. So we went in. So now, you know, circling back around, when it came back to naming, you're like, hey, I've got this thing, and we're going to call it a Cryptid Cafe, because I now have been introduced to the term a little bit more formally. And they're like, no, just Cryptid Cafe. That's perfect. Just do that. And that was a really good catalyst, because it then led to, oh, we'll just make all of our creatures in the game cryptids. And so now I didn't have to reinvent this wheel of all these creatures. And what came along with it are the super fans. Mothman fans are insane. They love Mothman, right? They, oh my gosh, when we were doing the voting on the actual, like, what are going to be the four unique meeples that we include in there? I mean, you'd see it in the post, like, go Mothman, team Mothman. We have to have Mothman in this thing, or I'm going to die, right? It was awesome seeing that enthusiasm for a 30 millimeter wooden creature who might be in the game, right? It was so, so cool. We had 5 menu items in the first game. And we're like, and so now we kind of cryptified them into this next game, into the cryptid version, cryptid cafe version. But I didn't have a 5th item. And I'm like, hey, I need an idea for a 5th menu item. Let me have it. And I just kind of I showed the 4 that we had. When I had a question mark on the 5th, it's probably still up on my Facebook page, but I would love to hear your ideas. I didn't offer anything. I mean, I didn't say, you know, someone's going to get a free game or anything like that, but I just wanted people's feedback. And we had amazing stuff. I mean, just absolutely amazing stuff. I was like, well, I kind of want to stay away from desserts. I want a new drink. And someone came up with hot apple spider. And I was like, that is awesome. And I was like, as soon as they posted it, I knew exactly what it was going to look like. I drew it. I posted it the very next day. I'm like, hot apple spider, here it is. And I was like, yes, that's perfect. And, you know, afterwards, I'm like, you know what? I'm sending you a game. That was a brilliant idea. You're going to get a copy of the game. And I actually might use one of the other items that they came up with, which was Tiramisu, which was a fantastic name. I was like, Tiramisu, I like that. But we already had our desserts. But now I'm actually, that might be a title of another game that I've already got going on that, you know, Andrew and I just talked about a couple of days ago. And, you know, if that's the case, then yeah, I'll send them a copy of the game because it was a brilliant idea and they should get something for it. So for, as far as sounding salesy, I didn't offer a reward for it, right? I just wanted their feedback and they were super excited about it. And when they saw that I incorporated that feedback, they knew I was listening. And that, I think that was the absolute key, because like, we had feedback on a lot of the artwork. They feel like they're just kind of pasted in the restaurant. They're really not doing anything. I was like, oh man, that's great. I didn't see that. And so then we started creating characters that were actually doing things in the restaurant. So like you have the Loveland Frogman and he's got his wand and he's making the salt and pepper shaker balance in air. So now he's doing something within that space. And you know, the Bunyip is having trouble with his laptop and the Thunderbird is actually playing chess, right, in a cafe. So we had them start doing all these cafe things and it showed that we listened and people loved it. And they started suggesting like, what could the Yeti be doing? He could be reading a book about taking a summer vacation, right? So again, all of that listening and acknowledging what they were saying, incorporating it into it and making them feel like they were part of that development process was huge. It was so cool to see that. Going back to our email list of 100 strong people, 75 of them, including a grandma, being on that list, it was terrible. So I think you and I touched base, feels like it was in November late October, right around that time. We kind of crossed paths and like, oh, we might be able to help each other out. we might be able to come up with something where we both benefit. And
thinking at the time, I just needed, every once in a while we get asked for high quality graphic designers and things like that. And it's like, you know, Chip's a good dude who's been doing a lot of stuff in the, you know, in the board game groups and whatnot. Maybe he would be a good referral source. And, you know, I think that's why I originally reached out and said hi.
Yeah, or something. Yeah, I think that's what it was, something along those lines. I think in one of those conversations, we saw that I was not doing advertising or marketing as well as I should within like Facebook and so forth. And the game industry spends a lot of time on Facebook, right? It's either there or BGG. And I don't know how to get my head around BGG. I still go there and I get hot under the collar. I'm like, I can't handle this site sometimes. And I don't know if it's just the bulletin board format or something like that. I need to get better at it and I'm not good at it. So I was like, I'm going to just focus on what I do know, a little bit of Facebook. And I think you and I just sat down and did like a whole session about how you, and this is kind of what you just said for our BGDL, right? Where you kind of sat down and walked, this is how we create an audience. And I was like, okay, perfect. Let's have you do that because I don't want, that's something I can potentially get off my plate. So one question a lot of people have, how far out do I need to start marketing? And I put us under the gun because I was doing a complete redo and I wanted to launch by the end of January. It's like, this is my timeline. Everything's going to be done and this, we're going to hit this date. And so I only gave us, 2 months worth of advertising time. Like we did December and January.
Yeah.
But you guys managed to, knowing this cryptid audience, you guys managed to really zero in on who they were going to be, what they liked. And we grew that list to over 1,000 people in 7 or 8 weeks. It was nuts. I mean, we have a great return on it. And what I learned from that, and I think this can apply to other people, is that you don't need to reach the entire board game industry. Again, you just need to reach those super fans that are in your niche that like your theme. That's who you need to reach. Like only reached 1,500. I mean, I don't want to say only because we had 1,500 backers, right? That's, which is awesome. But again, in the big scope of how many gamers there are, we captured a very, 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 very small bit of them, right?
Yeah, that's awesome. Love it.
All right, that's all the time we have for this week's episode of Crowdfunding Nerds. A big thank you and shout out to Chip Cole of Squatchy Games for joining us in this week's podcast. For more information on Chip, Squatchy, or Cryptid Cafe, visit his website at www.squatchygames.com. That's SQUATCHYGames.com. And of course, as always, if you guys have any crowdfunding questions or concerns for us, feel free to visit our website at crowdfundingnerds.com/question to put those questions in and we'll respond to you as soon as we can. So thank you all for listening to us this week. Build those games, get those people, and stay nerdy.
Agreed.
That's a good one.